Welcome to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Carl Gerke. Coming up later this hour, today is the anniversary of Custer's last stand, and we'll talk with historian Jeff Barnes about some of Custer's earlier stands on the Great Plains. Plus, we'll talk with young Kansas singer-songwriter Chantel Leitner, who's on her first extensive tour. That includes a stop in Aberdeen tomorrow. But first, it's Wednesday and time for our weekly discussion of state politics with the Dakota Political Junkies. Joining us today is Denise Ross, web editor of the Mitchell Daily Republic. And Denise, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Carl.
Also here is Jonathan Ellis, reporter and columnist for the Sioux Falls Argus Leader. And Jonathan, nice to have you with us as well.
Hey, thanks, Carl.
Well, the Supreme Court is making a lot of news this week, and I think we should wade into a little bit of that, if you're okay. First of all, today, the Supreme Court voted 5-4 to strike down the Defense of Marriage Act that denies federal benefits to same-sex couples who are legally married in the states where they reside. And the court also voted 5-4 to let stand a lower court's ruling that California's Proposition 8 banning same-sex marriage is unconstitutional. Denise, what do these rulings mean for states in which gay marriage isn't legal, states like South Dakota?
Well, I don't have a crystal ball to say exactly what would happen, of course, but I think you could look for legal challenges to start being launched from these states. The type of advocacy groups typically look for individuals like a good test case, and so I think with these high court rulings, it's going to be a pretty low bar to find those kinds of cases to say somebody who wants to get married but isn't allowed to under state law. I can't remember the exact year, but sometime within the last decade, South Dakota voters put into the state constitution a provision banning gay marriage, if I remember that correctly. So that will be an interesting dynamic. I think the California case was a constitutional amendment as well. So I think you're going to just start to see, as these cases work their way through the courts, these provisions being struck down kind of in a domino effect. I don't see that the opponents of gay marriage have a lot of legal maneuvering left to do, but we'll see what happens.
Jonathan Ellis?
Yeah, I don't think that there's necessarily the rulings today, there's nothing immediate that comes to South Dakota and other states, but I think Denise is correct that longer term, maybe it's opening the door for some other litigation. And I think that realistically, politically, that in a lot of places, this will be solved politically, and at some point, you would expect in the high court to actually take up an issue, much like with regard to the California issue, take up something that's more widespread. So, I think that you'll see both on two fronts. You'll see politically attitudes are changing on this subject, and you'll see changes in some states, and legally, you'll also see potentially something that will have a more profound statement on the laws like South Dakota, the constitutional amendments.
How historic was this ruling? Looking at the big picture here.
I'm still trying to process it. I don't really know. I mean, the DOMA ruling is applies to the handfuls of states where that's already, where same-sex marriage is already legal, so it doesn't really affect us. But it's certainly, how historic, I don't know, but it certainly is, incrementally, these changes have been coming, both now legally and politically.
Denise Rotz, any thoughts on the historic nature of the rulings?
Yeah, I was going to say that I think this is the courts catching up with the country. I mean, you've just seen a really rapid switch in public opinion where it's almost been reversed from, say, a 70-30 public opinion poll against gay marriage to just the opposite numbers where you have a 70-30 split in favor of it. And it's happened over just the last couple of years. And so you've seen politicians, even here in South Dakota, change their position on that matter, where they've gone from being opposed to it to being in favor of gay marriage. And that's all because of the public opinion polls. And it's a politically disadvantageous these days to be opposed to this.
Well, yesterday the U.S. Supreme Court issued a couple of rulings that will or could affect the state's Native American population. In one, the 5-4 ruling on the Indian Child Welfare Act, the court said federal law doesn't require that a Native American child be taken away from her adoptive parents and given to her biological father. And former South Dakota Senator James Aberesk helped pass the Indian Child Welfare Act in 1978. And Jonathan Ellis, what has been his reaction to the court's ruling?
He's not too happy. I mean, he disagrees with the court's interpretation, and as he put it, I mean, he and others think that this is an attack on tribal sovereignty, and you know, it's important to go back and historically why that was put into place, why Senator Aberesk thinks the court is wrong in there. I mean, there, you know, historically that there were churches and government organizations throughout our settlement of America and beyond that you know many Native American children were just taken away from the tribes and put in schools or taken you know put with white parents. I mean there was an attempt to really on some levels to sort of just eradicate Native American culture. And so that, you know, this whole the act that Senator Aberesk was so instrumental in getting passed in the 1970s was an attempt to, address that. And so I think that, he views this, certainly he stole our paper, that he views that he thinks the Supreme Court was wrong.
Well, Denise Ross, I don't know how close you've been following the Oglala Sioux Tribes lawsuit claiming temporary custody hearings in Rapid City violate the Indian Child Welfare Act. I'm wondering if this ruling could affect that lawsuit.
I really don't think so, because this was really very narrowly drawn to this specific set of circumstances where you had a Native father who had voluntarily given up his parental rights. So his parental rights had been terminated, and the mother then chose to give the child up to an adoptive family. And then the father comes back and wants the child back and uses this as sort of a legal tool in the legal toolbox. And that's really what ICWA was designed for, was to prevent what Jonathan was talking about, where you have sort of the white majority government officials coming in and removing Native kids from their families, where you haven't had this whole process of parental rights being terminated and a child being placed up for adoption and all of these things. So this is a very narrow circumstance, and I don't think you're going to see widespread change to the way it was being applied. I think what you've seen in South Dakota is Native advocates and tribes saying that ICWA hasn't been followed, you know, that sort of core piece of ICWA that the state hasn't been following that. And so I think that's going to be a different court case, and I think we should still watch that pretty closely.
Also, yesterday, on a 5-4 vote, the majority of justices ruled Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act unconstitutional, and that's the section that determines which states must receive preclearance from the Justice Department or federal court before making changes to voting procedures. Now, Jonathan Ellis, that this could have some impact on the South Dakota counties that have a large Native American population?
Yeah, I mean, South Dakota is subject to a couple of South Dakota counties, and Denise, you probably know offhand which ones. It's slipping my mind.
Shannon and Todd, yes.
Yeah, Shannon
part
and Todd.
Of the redistricting, yeah.
Right. They're subject to that, and in the Section 4, specifically relates to the formula in which, you know, I think the original one dates back all the way to 1968. And what this does, and I mean, I think that the voting advocates here are understandably, given some historical litigation regarding voting, they're a little upset by this. But I think, as you indicated earlier in the news story you had on, that the bulk of the law still remains in place. What it means is that changes that the state wants to make in terms of precincts or boundaries, and the Justice Department won't pre-approve those changes. But if defendants or if voters in those counties think that the state makes a change now that still violates the law, then they can bring suit. I think the disappointment for the voting rights advocates down there is that, you know, the Justice Department is overseeing this on the front end.
Well, moving on from the Supreme Court rulings this week, last week the Farm Bill failed in the House, and that was surprising to some because it was believed that the bill would pass because Republican leadership sponsored it. Denise Ross, what happened?
Well, my impression from out here in South Dakota is that no one was more surprised than the House leaders themselves. Kristi Noem had a conference call. I believe it was the morning after that vote took place, and it was the most fired up, I will say, I've ever heard her. I didn't see her, but I've heard her. She was fired up, and she was not happy about it, obviously. This has kind of been an albatross around her neck ever since she got to Congress trying to get this farm bill passed. And the big question now is what happens. I mean, you've got, if you read any of the national news sources, you have people starting to seriously talk about, is there not going to be a farm bill? Is our nation's egg policy just going to sort of melt away? And it should worry people in the egg industry that conversation is taking place, and I'm sure they're paying very close attention. It's kind of hard to fathom that we wouldn't have some kind of agriculture policy, some kind of food policy. But the Farm Bill has just gotten the different provisions in it, the different subsidies have just gotten unpopular. And then when you see the rise of the Tea Party, you know, it's just a really big target for them to take aim at. And this also was maybe not as much about the Farm Bill as it was about internal Republican Party politics over in the House caucus, where you've got this rebellious group of Tea Partiers and the leaders that, you know, I'm watching to see what happens to John Boehner's speakership. He may not be speaker in a couple of years. You know, this has a lot of ramifications beyond just ag policy.
Well, I'm wondering if there was, Jonathan Ellis, if there was any chance that the bill would get the Democrat support with the cuts in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, the food stamps.
You know, there was, I think, initially enough support. I mean, there was a lot of resistance among Democrats because there were cuts to the food stamp program, and there were, you know, my reading of it, there were enough Democrats who were willing to go along and vote for the bill, get it to conference with the Senate, and then figure all that out later. What happened was there was an amendment that was added near the end that would have allowed, I think, a program in which some states could experiment with requiring recipients to have to work in order to get food stamps, and that program cost a lot of Democratic votes. That amendment was added to the bill. It cost a lot of Democratic votes. It's interesting that among the 62 Republicans who voted against the Farm Bill, I think all but two of them voted for that particular amendment. I mean, to me it's interesting in that, and Denise references this group of Tea Partiers. This House bill on the Farm Bill, it really achieved a lot of the goals, I think, that Republicans have been articulating that they want, which is, you know, cutting some subsidies and so forth, you know. It wasn't a perfect bill, I suppose, if you're a Tea Partier, but it really incrementally got, you know, Republicans closer to what they want. And to me, it's just been very interesting about how the, you know, House Republicans really seem to be incapable of moving incrementally in the way they want to go. I mean, that was evident with the debt ceiling negotiations in the summer of 2011. They refused to take a deal that was offered to them, and so in the end, when we got to the end of the year, last year, they ended up with a much, much worse deal than they would have gotten if they would have bargained in 2011. So I'm really amazed that they just seem incapable of incrementally getting to where they want to go.
Well, Denise Ross, does the failure of the Farm Bill in the House for second year, does this hurt Congresswoman Kristi Noem?
I don't know. I thought it would hurt her the first time around, and it didn't seem to make a dent at all. And so it's really hard to tell how this will affect things going forward. And again, I said before on this show, I'd love to be a fly on the wall at like the Kennebec farmers, you know, the elevator there where the farmers gather and talk about this kind of stuff, because that's where you're going to really see if that crowd starts to become angry about this and get fired up about this, and if their patience runs thin, it could hurt her. I don't know if they would blame her at this point for that. It will depend, and it will be a real test for her to see how she handles it if that sort of thing does happen.
Jonathan, do you see this will have any effect at all on Kristi Noem, particularly looking ahead to 2014?
Yeah, certainly potentially. I mean, the one benefit that Kristi Noem has right now is life has been pretty good in farm country the last few years. I mean, there's not, you know, we're not looking at any kind of major crisis, farm crisis. I mean, we had a drought last year, but overall, you know, things have been pretty good. So that there's not like this emergency, but you know, uncertainty bothers everybody in business. I mean, so now there's discussions about, well, where are we going to even have any farm policy? So the uncertainty is bad. And you know, going into a race, I mean, you know, she'll be pointed at as, hey, you're part of the problem. There nobody's getting anything done. So she can be attacked, from somebody who's running as sort of an outsider. Say, look, this Congress, they can't get anything done. We need to elect new people. I mean, that certainly exposes her to some criticism.
Does it open any doors for Democrats?
Find me a Democratic candidate, the right one, and sure does.
Denise?
Yeah, it has to be the right Democrat, the right candidate, to kind of bring that message with some credibility and not look like they're just trying to capitalize on the mess. And it is a mess. I haven't heard anybody come back and say they know what's going to happen next, even. So, I don't know. It's very interesting. Like, I would not have ever imagined this would happen with the Farm Bill.
Well, moving on to something that you wrote, Jonathan, in your blog for the Argus Leader. You wrote about the Sunlight Foundation's report on elite political donors. And what is that report?
Well, the Sunlight Foundation is an organization that advocates for government transparency and records and so forth. And so they put together a report of the elite political donors of the 2012 cycle. And what that is the people who it's 0.01% of the U.S. population, about 31,300 people, who made about 27-28% of all of the political donations. And so that group of people represents sort of the elite political donors, and they carry, and obviously they have a lot of influence now in politics. And in the way the Sunlight Foundation frames it, that, you know, you almost have to get some of these people to donate to your campaign. I mean, they're sort of the gatekeepers to the political system. I mean, they donated, and especially in off-presidential years, they have an enormous amount of influence in terms of political giving. And in South Dakota, there were 50 South Dakotans who qualified as these elite political givers during the 2012 cycle.
And virtually all of their money went to Republicans?
In South Dakota, yeah. In South Dakota, virtually all of it went to Republicans, and we're talking, I pulled up the spreadsheet here, but from a low, the 50th person was $13,000, and that varied all the way to $94,250, so from the top political donor in South Dakota. So that's, I mean, I Carl, did you make $13,000? You were probably just at $12,500. You didn't quite make the elite
list.
Yeah,
just a little bit below.
You know, I mean, a lot of people just can't imagine making $10,000 in political contributions or $5,000. Yeah, and to be making almost $100,000, I mean, that's just astounding to a lot of people. So this group of people, and I know some of them, and we probably all do, they carry a lot of weight in our political process.
Well, Denise Ross, I don't know if you had an opportunity to look at Jonathan's blog there, but I'm wondering if, you know, given the so much money goes to the Republicans for the big donors, is this something that needs to change if Democrats want to be more competitive in South Dakota, or that's just the way things have been for a while?
I don't know. I haven't read Jonathan's blog post yet, but I bet I could name some of the people who are on the list without too much trouble. I think that there are other more fundamental pieces of our democratic system that could change, that would help Democrats more. The redistricting process, in putting that in the hands of politicians, seems silly to me. I've never understood why you would do that. And then the ruling out of the Supreme Court today, with the way the voting and the elections are handled, again, that process is in the hands of politicians. And when you've got these racial minorities voting overwhelmingly Democratic, it's just ripe for partisan mischief, not necessarily racist mischief, but partisan mischief. And I think if you could in some way get that process out of the hands of the politicians, I think that would go a long way to, if the Democrats need help, they can help themselves with a lot of other things too, like Jonathan said, finding the right kinds of candidates. And they get a lot of money outside of the state of South Dakota, so money is important, but it's not the only factor.
All right. Well, Denise, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with us on Dakota Midday today.
Thank you.
And Jonathan, nice to talk with you as well.
Thanks, Carl.